Namaskar, everybody. I'm joined today by my good friend and drone expert, Shaban Naeem, and we're going to be talking about the draft of India's drone policy and the use of drones for commercial purposes in India. It's Thursday, November 9th, and you're listening to Drishti Talk. Welcome to the show, Shaban. How are you?
Thank you for inviting me, Chirag. I'm very well.
So India has drafted a new policy for remote pilot aircraft systems, which is quite a mouthful, but we'll just call them drones, which is available for public comment until the 1st of December. I'm going to leave a link for everybody in the show notes, as well as the contact point if anybody wants to leave comments. Shaban, let's start by talking about why such a policy is really important.
Well, India being a massive tech hub, the drone industry is a natural sort of bed to grow in India. Unfortunately, because we've not had official regulations for quite a while now, the United States announced regulations a couple of years ago. The UAE's had official regs 2014, and then they brought it into force in 2015. So that was about 3 years ago. And India's just had an all-out ban officially. RPAS or drones weren't really technically allowed to operate commercially. So this is a huge step forward. India, I think, is a huge market. And there's a lot of good drones can do for both businesses and for government agencies. And it's good to see that they're finally looking at commercial framework for operators to start work there.
For a casual observer, they think of things like drone photography, for example, which obviously is quite huge in Indian weddings. Where would be the real value add or the real benefit for commercial entities to be able to operate these devices?
So, well, of course, everyone's seen drones flying around in adverts, and of course, weddings are super popular, even though technically that's supposed to be illegal if you go by the letter of the law. But the real value is, for me as a commercial drone operator, I can tell you straight away, agriculture, we have a huge agricultural sector. And a lot of people say, wait a minute, if you're going to invest money into drones and agriculture, we may as well invest it for better farming tools and for better, things for the subsidies for the farmers. But I'll tell you this, what drones allow you to do is to gather information at a fraction of the cost. And that's what, when I say, drones are going to be helpful for the agricultural sector in India, that's what I mean. A small SME or medium-sized business, or even, your everyday Joe farmer who wants access to this technology, doesn't have to rely on satellite data or doesn't have to hire a full-size aircraft to do a survey of hundreds and thousands of acres of land. They can get a drone that's less than $2,000 and at least start getting some information. What does that information mean? Well, it allows you to target certain areas of your crop to see whether they're sick, and then just use pesticides in those areas. So that's good for you and me as consumers, where we will benefit because there's not going to be an overuse of pesticides. You can figure out which areas are being overwatered. You can figure out how plant health is. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. This is stuff you can do from the get-go. There are many, many more applications when you start adding specialized sensors. So agriculture being a massive sector for us as a country, we do a lot of exports. This would be a huge boon. Second thing is urban infrastructure, I think, is another area where drones can be a huge benefit. If you want to look at city planning, rural development, you can fly out drones and create up-to-date maps of these areas, which you would have to normally, requisition a satellite for. And that can cost anywhere between $10,000 to $20,000. And most people just don't want to be bothered with this stuff. With drones, it's an accessible technology. It's quite mature now. You can go out and get it. You don't have to be an aviation expert for some of these consumer grade drones to be able to operate them. And you'll see a lot of benefits, again, at a very significantly low price point. Apart from infrastructure and agriculture, there's obviously the security aspect for government agencies. And it goes without saying, I think this is the most important sector. We're one of the tech mega giants in the world, right? If you want to outsource technology development, India is right up there with the best of them. And this is where I think drones are going to be another place of huge growth, because I don't expect people to start building, custom hardware solutions in India right now, we are massive on software. And there's a big gap in software. And India is so good at developing software. So you'll see a huge boon in the software industry. People are going to start writing apps for drones. They're going to start building operating systems, firmware for existing autopilots and commercial drone systems. So you'll see a big, big boon in that sector as well. That, I think, kind of sums up the top four sectors, as per my opinion.
let's move on into the policy or the regulations itself. How do you feel about the overall draft as it stands today?
Well, I have mixed feelings about the draft. There are certain things which I think are excellent and they're quite detailed. Clearly, a lot of thought has been put into it. We have things like classifications of drones, right? They've put in areas where you can and can't fly, and they have very strict requirements on how they want to do things. And the reason I said it's mixed is because there's also the flip side where there are certain things which I think are inherently, they could be a little difficult for businesses to operate if some of these regulations are implemented as they stand, which is why we're actually having this discussion, because I believe they're inviting people to give feedback. And hopefully when commercial operators read this, they will give them the right feedback and we will have a more positive changes. I believe there should be a demarcation between hobby grade rules and rules for commercial operators. This is a major issue all across the world where one set of rules is applied to everyone, which doesn't really make sense. The majority of security breaches that you hear about all across the world, some person flying this drone near an airport or some person flying somewhere where they're not supposed to, or breaching someone's privacy and all this nonsense, is actually caused by hobbyists. Very few commercial companies are actually in the news for causing trouble, because commercial companies care about their businesses, they care about their reputation, they don't take undue risks usually. Regulators don't really see this always. I'm not saying this to be mean to regulators everywhere, but this is just a fact of life. When they draft regulations, they draft it for everyone. So hobbyists and commercial guys get plugged into the same category, and that doesn't always work well in the favor of innovation. If you want to, you know, encourage the spirit of innovation and encourage adoption of new technology, you have to target the right industries to encourage them, and then target the problem areas to discourage those. So that's what I feel, I think.
What you're saying essentially is that because drones are easy to get to today, and it's a technology that hobbies are getting into a lot, the regulators look at the threat alone and then apply stringent laws to everybody. And then this would slightly adversely, but impact a company that might actually be in it for the good, but they have to still abide by the same restrictions because the regulator is trying to be hard on the hobbyist, right?
Yes, absolutely. 110%. That's a real issue. So, for example, I have friends and associates who operate UAVs in the UK or in the US, and like sometimes they'll actually have a permit. They'll be wearing their safety jackets. They'll have the cones deployed and they'll say, okay, UAV is currently being operated in this spot, and people will still call the cops on them, because there's this inherent suspicion around drones, which is justified. You know, I'm not saying that the average person shouldn't have an opinion, but there's also unfortunately media tendencies to blow things out of proportion because it makes for a good headline, and that is a big problem for drone operators everywhere. One person will do something stupid, and the media will completely blow it out of proportion, and they will show pictures of completely unrelated drones, and that sends the wrong message. And again, regulatory authorities, this is an unprecedented emerging technology, right? If there was a drone industry, commercial drone industry, rather, there's been a drone industry for like 50 years now, but if there was a commercial drone industry that was completely mature, then regulators would know how to deal with it. Right now, it's like most civil aviation authorities have experiences, you know, working with full-size aircraft. They know how to regulate helicopters and planes and gyrocopters. They don't know how to deal with unmanned aircraft because, you know, it's a different ballgame. So when they don't know how to deal with it and they see these problems, they just clamp down hard, and that causes issues for everyone. For India, I really, really hope, considering how much benefit this technology can bring to our country, I really hope that they allow the sensible use of commercial drones. And like I said, do a more targeted approach instead of a blanket ban on certain things.
Let's get to the regulations themselves, right? So part A, as we mentioned already, is the classification of the drones. Now, I'm not going to go into every single category in a lot of detail, but essentially there's five of them. There's nano, which is everything under 250 grams in terms of, and this is classified by what they call maximum takeoff weight. And then there's a micro, a mini, a small, and a large. To help us understand a little bit more practically what that actually means, what can a drone that has a total weight of about 250 grams, which is classified as a nano, so what can that possibly contain?
Nano drones can be your toy drones that you get, these little cheap toys you can get from China. Now, I'll tell you one thing, which I tell everyone that I talk to about drones, is just because you pick up a small toy from China does not necessarily mean that it's actually a drone. A drone is a device that has some level of autonomy or some level of intelligence into it. It's got a flight computer or some flight controller inside it. Some of these things are just little quadcopters with four little motors, and they balance themselves, and you know, that's it. If you were to take the remote control and break it or turn it off, these quadcopters would crash. They don't have any safety protocols. Proper drones actually have safety protocols and all of this. You know, there's a level of intelligence. So that's a big distinction. So less than 250 grams, you're looking at toys, you're looking at possibly racing drones, and all of this stuff that doesn't really carry much mass, and it can't, because it's so light, the batteries are quite small, and therefore they don't really fly for long durations, and they don't really pose that much of a threat. And 250 grams and below is the standard that's followed across the world as well in other countries.
And the reason I'm mentioning the nano drones is because essentially all the things that we're going to talk about after this, in terms of the different other requirements that drone operators need to have, the nano drone is almost exempt from most of this stuff, right? They don't need the permits and so on. We could look at this as a way of them trying to separate out what would essentially be, you know, as you mentioned, someone picking up a quote-unquote toy or something from a store and just flying it in his lawn. Is this why they classify it this way?
I think so, because it takes a lot of the stuff that would cause a huge bandwidth problem. Let's put it into context. Currently, nano drones, anything that's below 250 grams, they don't need a unique identification number. So you don't have to go through a lot of those processes that you would have to. Plus, they are allowed to fly up to 50 feet area. So within 0 to 50 feet, you can fly your nano drone. That's fine, no problem. But if you fly your nano drone above 50 feet, you're technically supposed to get permissions. That's where you enter the red line is, basically. So because they're toys, they shouldn't be flying above 50 feet anyway. If you really look at it, this kind of makes sense. And if you're an RC enthusiast or hobbyist, you're going to be flying it at an airfield. And again, that's also within visual line of sight. So this kind of clears up that clutter you would have of people trying to get little toys or just really makes no sense.
Let's talk about the unique identification number that you mentioned. Every drone that should fly, anything above nano, requires a unique identification number akin to a car license plate, right? You want to get your vehicle on the road, you've got to tag it. This is pretty straightforward. But the interesting thing to me here is that within the regulation itself, they've defined that as long as all the documents are intact, the turnaround time to get one of these should be 2 days. I mean, I don't know how this compares to everywhere else, but this sounds like a pretty reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw 2 days, I was quite surprised. If you can push through the security protocols and all the background checks and whatever they're going to be running in 2 days, that's great. But look, it could also just be 2 days to get a UIN, but then there's other processes that need to be followed. So again, we don't really know where it really stands, but 2 days is a pretty good turnaround time. Absolutely.
So the next step that's required here is the unmanned aircraft operator permit. UAOP. This is a little bit more than just, I'm just drawing parallels to cars to make it easier, but this is just a little bit more than a license, because this permit is attached to both, right? It's attached to the quote-unquote qualification of the person, operating the drone, but also it's also tied to the location. You also need, for example, the landowner's permission, as well as like whatever the necessary insurance and other things. Again, here, the one standout for me was that the validity of this permit once approved is expected to be 5 years. So it would technically mean that, if you're flying this for a customer or surveying his sites or whatever, you can put the paperwork through one time and then you don't have to keep going back every time you want to make the flight or every 6 months or a year, depending on how it looks. And again, here, the turnaround time is, the anticipated turnaround time is about 7 days.
Yeah, quoting the regulations under section 7.5, the validity of the UAOP shall be for a period of 5 years from the date of issue. And the renewal of the UAOP shall be subject to fresh security clearance from the MHA. So every 5 years, you have to get security cleared from the Ministry of Home Affairs. So this is non-transferable. So again, 5 years is pretty good. A lot of countries have it annually. You know, I'm quite happy with 5 years. I would not change that. That's a good ballpark figure to start.
Let's dive into the pilot training specs, right? The operator needs to be at least 18 years. I think that's fair. They need to have ground training similar to someone who operates a helicopter or a small plane, and also has to go through simulated flight training.
Well, okay. So having someone who's 18 years of age, I think that makes sense, considering, you know, the civil aviation is treating drones, you know, as an aerial vehicle. So if you're old enough to drive, you're old enough to fly, and hopefully you'll have some level of maturity when you're operating one of these things. But yeah, I'm fine with 18 years of age. Absolutely, yes. What is not, I think, I wouldn't say it's not okay, but I think what needs to be revised is this ground operations training. Because a lot of the times we look at drones and look at full-size aircraft. They need a runway to operate. They need, you know, air traffic control. They need, you know, there's a whole different bunch of layers of things that need to happen to get an aircraft into the air. You know, you have to have a ground operations. You have to have radio systems, comm systems, satellite systems, da da da, and, you know, an entire network all across the country. For a small commercial drone, like a little Phantom take to take off, you really have to take it out of its box. You have to go through a quick flight checklist. And if it's in an area where the drone sees that there's a no-fly zone, it's not there, it's allowed to fly, you just, you know, press a button, off it goes. So this whole thing of requiring extensive ground operations that is, you know, comparable to someone who's training on a full-size airplane, that I think needs to be revised because it's unnecessary. A lot of these guys are not ever going to be dealing with drones who require these kind of procedures. Having said that, you have to understand that maybe you should apply ground ops for drones that are upwards of 100 kilos, because that makes sense. A 100 kilo drone, you're not talking about a multi-rotor here. You're talking about an aircraft. Right? Something like an RQ-9 or some of these things weigh multi-tons. Yeah, then you have ground ops involved. But for a mini drone or something that's lightweight and is simple to operate, that's a little overkill. And it could cause issues as well for operators to get clearance and to get trained. And I think that needs to be revised.
Essentially, what we're looking at is, while all the other aspects, right, the classification and the getting the ID and so on, seem relevant to drones, when it comes to the training aspect, they seem to have gone the same way as they do, you know, all civil aviation, right? Which is aggressive and intense in terms of ground training, in terms of, you know, flight planning and everything. Is that accurate?
Well, yes. There are a couple of things that they've covered which are absolutely necessary. So drone operators should absolutely know about basic radio tech, right? So let's say you're flying on 2.4 gigahertz and you have Wi-Fi, which also runs on 2.4 gigahertz, and you have a massive Wi-Fi emitter nearby. You could run into like reduced range or noise on your channel. Having an idea of how basic radio tech works can save potentially crashes and save, increase your safety margin. Some of it can be a little contested, right? ATC procedures is one of those things which I'm not so sure that every operator would need to know. Again, it depends. If you're flying in Class B airspace or one of these airspaces which full-size aircraft operate in, and you have to get your drones to comply with that, then absolutely yes. ATC procedures and knowledge of how that works and understanding how ATC operates is absolute necessity for those requirements. But if you're not, and majority of drones don't fly that high, don't fly in a space with full-size traffic as well, they fly underneath all of that, then you don't really need to know that. You should always inform ATC or ATS, depending on where you are. You should always inform the local tower if you're operating in their airspace, so they have some idea of what's going on. And that should be part of standard operating procedures, provided you're in an area of dense traffic. I believe there's a section in the regulation that says if you're not within a restricted zone and if you're away from dense air traffic and you're flying within the 200 feet, then you just need to contact local law enforcement, but you don't have to get in touch with ATC.
It's mini and above.
Yeah, I really wish they didn't use this mini thing. Is throwing me off because we don't really call it mini. Just because that implies that it's mini and it's not. It's not mini. I'd actually like to say this on record as well. Don't call it mini. It's not a mini thing.
So the way they've drafted this is it's mini and above need permits. Micro only needs a permit if you're flying about 200. But if you're flying below 200 and it's a micro classified drone, then you do need to inform the local police that you're about to operate one.
Provided you're operating your micro RPA in uncontrolled airspace. But also you have to understand there's other three words after this which are quite dicey, right? And it says clear of prohibited, restricted, and danger area. That is such a broad classification that it's very hard. What is prohibited? What is restricted? And what is danger? So let's say the common sense will tell you, obviously, prohibited means, you know, if you're flying over a power plant or...
But they've given us some criteria, right? So they've mentioned the temporary segregated areas and temporary reserved areas as whatever is done by the airports authority. And then somewhere later, they haven't even mentioned the things where you can't fly regardless, right? You've got the eco-sensitive zones and blah, blah, blah. Those are all the prohibited ones. And anything that's on the Ministry of Home Affairs list.
They've arrived it from their point of view. They need to also look at it from everybody else's point of view. The average Joe is not necessarily going to come to the same common sense conclusion that they're coming from, you know. For them, it's common sense to like not be around an airport and fly a drone there, but look at what's been happening for the last 3 years. That common sense has been thrown out the door. If you're going to say, if you're going to put broad words over there, you have to really drill down and specify, okay, when we say dangerous and prohibited, this is exactly what we mean. We don't expect you to know this, but we're telling you. Here's the thing. Do your homework before you go out and fly, all right? If there's something there that is a potential bone of contention, don't just say, okay, I'm going to plead ignorance if something goes bad. No.
you're not going to plead ignorance. The regulations say that if there's a potential possibility of an issue, you go and you damn well investigate why and who you have to contact, and whatever you need to do to negate problems, you go out and you do that. You don't plead the fifth, so to speak. Yeah, and don't just follow this list that has been drafted and sent by the aviation authorities as the holy grail, because it's not. Yeah.
So one of the items that they mentioned, I think it's in two places now. If you're flying a certain category of drone, even if you don't need a permit, you know, you must let the local authorities know. How much do you think that would help? We have to make an assumption that the local police authorities are fully aware of possible implications with all this stuff, and that's naturally not a fair assumption.
It will absolutely get in the way. This is the first thing they will do. They'll be like, okay, where is your UAOP? And you'll be like, no, I don't need one. And they'll be like, okay, well, we're not going to let you fly until we confirm. So if you have a 2-day window to fly, and the third day is going to be raining and there's going to be thunderstorms, you're out of luck, because that means till they confirm from their side what the issue, what the regulations are, and you can show them all the paperwork you like. Having this whole contact to local police authority is an issue. Better to just have a UAOP for this category and give it to the person, so that. And then you say, all right, I'm going to fly here. I'm contacting you on the channels that have been provided to me. And here's my UAOP. Have it one way or the other, but don't do a compromise that affects both parties.
Yeah, and there's no way, at least I can foreseeably see as of now anyway, that every local police authority is going to be trained when this regulation comes out, you know, in January. Of what it involves and what they can and cannot do with respect to this. Because mind you, the regulation isn't entirely clear either, because all it says is inform. So what happens when you inform, right?
When you inform, the police will automatically will go into a mode of, okay, we've been informed of something. Do we have a liability, or do we have to take any action again?
Yeah, that's not defined either, yeah.
And chances are they will clamp down. That particular point will definitely cause some woes for both parties.
So regarding the requirements, again, this applies to the larger drones. The drone should have an ID plate, GPS, strobe lights, RFID, SIM slots, and something called return to home. Can you first tell us what return to home means?
So remember when I told you a little earlier during this show, there's a difference between toy drones and real drones. RTA stands for return to home. Basically, if you are flying a drone that's shaped like a little saucer or an aircraft, doesn't matter. But if you're beyond 800 meters, chances are you're not going to be able to see it very well. There'll just be a little dot. And when it's a little dot and you're controlling it from your remote control or from a ground station, you're not able to judge whether it's moving left or right after a certain point. Because when it's close by, it's easy to see where the drone is going and what it's doing. But when it's really far away, orientation becomes a problem. And when drone operators lose orientation, or when they have issues with, let's say something goes wrong and you need to call the drone back, just pressing the back button on your stick may actually mean that drone is going to go left, because it will take its orientation based on where it's facing, right? We have all these different modes. It can get a little confusing. Depending which mode you're in, the easiest way to just sort all of this out is to press RTH, and the drone will fly back to where it took off from. Most drones will have a GPS location of where they've taken off from, which they call the home location, and they mark that in their memory. And when you press RTH, the drone flies back. This is a safety feature. It's built in case, let's say, the drone loses contact, radio contact with the operator, and then it doesn't receive further instructions. So its de facto is to do two things. Either it will check whether it has enough battery to go back home. If it does, it will. And if it doesn't, it realizes, no, I have a flight time of about 5 minutes remaining. And by the time, my time to home is 15 minutes, so 10 minutes, I don't have that kind of battery. Then it'll actually try and land. So the really smart drones are programmed to do these basic behavior checks and then execute the safety protocol accordingly.
Right, so the ID plate, GPS, these seem fairly standard, as is the return to home. How about the RFID and SIM slots? Are there any other implications to this?
Yes, so RFID and SIM does mean an extra layer of communication. First of all, RFID doesn't really work from beyond a certain distance. So you need to be in close proximity to an object to actually read its RFID tag. I don't know. I'm a little concerned about that. The other thing is GSM access. Something that's been developed here in the UAE is the ability to track drones based on inserting a SIM. So that SIM will have a little data plan on it, and it'll broadcast the drone's location to the relevant authorities. But again, this is additional complexity. Not all drones actually support RFID and support SIM card slots. And if the government's plan is to implement this, they have to understand that a lot of the commercial drones that you buy off the shelf from a shop, like a little Phantom, doesn't have an RFID built into it. It doesn't have a SIM card slot built into it. This will cause issues. And this is one of those other points in the document that needs to be addressed or revised. Here's what I think. In the UAE, they're developing a small box that talks to your drone's computer and then broadcasts all the data to your control center that then allows the government to track where all the drones are and where they're flying, whether they're breaching restricted airspace and all that stuff. It's a little bit pie in the sky right now. Still early days for this kind of tech to be implemented in all drones. But maybe having it there as part of regulations is important, but it shouldn't be mandatory. It should be a nice to have. If a drone company can produce a drone that has all of these safety features, maybe they can get special consideration for permits.
Or perhaps they could fly in areas that require permission compared to unrestricted space. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's say you're operating in the middle of Delhi, right? And there's significant military installation, significant air traffic areas, and you're near Safdarjung Airport. Maybe there, if you are going to do a delivery service, where you have to have drones operating X number of hours every single day in and day out. But for flying in a certain space where you're not disturbing anyone and you're doing like an agricultural flight where you're flying over fields of wheat or rice, this doesn't make any sense for that.
So again, more breakdown or more specifications or perhaps categorization.
Yeah. Either remove it or expand on it, but don't leave it in limbo. There's a requirement for obstacle avoidance, and that is an issue as well because you can't have a detect and avoid capability. It's listed under Section 11.2, Section D, detect and avoid capability. They need to specify what that means because a lot of drones have simple sonar or LiDAR laser-based range finding for detection and collision avoidance. But some drones don't. And they've put this for all RPA except Nano. New commercial drones you buy off the shelf may not have this. So that's another point that needs to be revised.
What reads like a very limiting factor or limiting regulation within the draft is the talk about line of sight. So there's three aspects that are mentioned outright. First is you're only allowed visual line of sight operations. Two, you're only allowed to fly during the daytime. And three, you can't fly off of a mobile platform or a moving vehicle. All three essentially imply that they don't want the drone operator to be out of sight with the drone. Why would this be the case and how limiting can this be?
So we are now coming to a section where I actually have a big bone to pick because I am not in agreement with some of them. I believe the whole point of having a drone is so you can fly beyond visual line of sight. You can fly an RC plane within 500 meters and see where it's going, and you can control it with your remote control. That's fine. But to do anything useful with any modern aircraft, you have to give it autonomy, which means it suddenly has the ability to fly beyond where you can see. That's the whole point of using drones. When you restrict RPA operations to visual line of sight only, you severely hamper the commercial use cases of drones. If you remember earlier, I told you agriculture is a huge sector for India. If you're limited to visual line of sight, the entire sector is out the door. No person can survey thousands of acres of land using a UAV within visual line of sight. It means he has to move every 10 minutes and he can't do that also because then he has to get into a car, which is also not allowed. This has to be revised if you want to see widespread use of commercial drones in India without problems.
So obviously this is, it sounds extremely limiting. Is there a security implication to this? Is that why this is done?
This is an Achilles heel, right? You have so many restrictions. You can't, look, this document is very, very comprehensive. They say stuff like you cannot fly on surface winds of more than 10 knots when most drones can do actually go higher than that. You cannot fly in visual meteorological conditions where visibility where the minimum ground visibility requirement is 5 kilometers and a cloud ceiling of not less than 450 meters. So they're so specific. Now, can you imagine when you're so specific and you have a drone which is past all of this and, the weather is perfect with below 10 knots and you have RFID, you have GPS, you have SIM card in it, but you can't fly beyond 800 meters. What's the point? What is the entire point? Because beyond 1 kilometer, you can't see the drone anyway. So you're beyond that limit. This entire thing falls completely off the wagon when you say, okay, we're going to have all of these restrictions, but in top of this, we're going to only allow you to fly within visual line of sight. It really makes no sense. Either you remove these restrictions and then say, okay, only visual line of sight flights, or you allow beyond visual line of sight and have these reasonable restrictions put in place for those flights. Why would you need a SIM card, right? If you're flying within 500 meters of where you are, why would you need a SIM card? You need a SIM card when you're flying 2 kilometers away, 3 kilometers away, when your radio is losing signal because you know you have a range of 2 kilometers, but then your drone can use 3G and 4G cell towers to broadcast its location. That's when this kind of technology comes into play. And they want this as part of the drone, but they will not allow you to fly beyond the visual aspect of things. And I think that makes no sense.
Okay, let's assume just as a hypothetical. That this is not a restriction that they have. Just the visual line of sight bit, right? How would they then deal with the security aspect of it? Because you have drones flying into airports and airspaces, which granted is a prohibited area, but this happens. By removing this restriction, there is a security implication. How do you deal with that?
By removing this restriction, there is a limited security implication, which has already been dealt with in this regulation. Like I said, when you have drones that are up to spec to get the UAOP, to get the UIN, they have all of these features that allow you to broadcast a drone's position, its heading, its altitude, all of this information to the regulatory authorities, while limited to visual line of sight. If you didn't have that, Chirag, then yes, there would be security implications. But because all of this has already been addressed, and it's super strict, I'll tell you this, the altitude for flights in the UAE is 400 feet. In other parts of the world, it's sometimes higher.
Yeah, I think even in Australia and the UK is what I saw is also 400 feet, yeah.
There you go. So India is half that. Here's the thing, Chirag. If you want to do an aerial survey of land and you're limited to 200 feet, you have to fly a lot longer and you have to fly multiple times, which means the cost for the client goes up, the cost for permits goes up, the paperwork associated with getting multiple days. So a flight that you could do in 2 days, you have to do it in 8 days. It's basically like scanning. The ability to fly higher gives you lower resolution but less time, which is sometimes more than enough. It's also useful in disaster response. So if there's a flood in the country somewhere and you're sending drones to help over there and they're limited to 200 feet, they will not be able to cover a big area because the higher they fly, the more area they can cover. This is a restriction. It's unnecessary. So bring it up to international standards, if not more, if you're feeling generous. On top of that, you have with restrictions of line of sight. I personally feel it's oversight, and I hope that when they get enough feedback that they will remove this because it's a big bone of contention. If it's not, then it's on purpose, and then they actually want to have a very restrictive policy towards drones. Time will tell. To answer your question about security implications, restrict hobbyists maybe to visual line of sight. Do not restrict professional drone operators whose drones and UAV systems are complying with so many different restrictions, yes, you put into place specifically for security purposes. It's like saying, okay, if you want to have an Airbus A330, it has to have, you know, the following kind of landing gear, the following kind of transponder, the following kind of lights, the following kind of fire extinguishing systems, the following kind of structure for safety of its passengers. Oh, and on top of this, you can't go beyond India's borders. Well, what's the point? Because the whole point of this is so that you can fly to other countries. You understand where I'm coming from.
One final point before we move on, which is the locations. Some of the stuff is pretty standard, as you would expect, distance from airports and things like that. The thing that I want to highlight here is they've said that it'd be about 500 meters away from MHA-defined locations and military installations.
If you're going to be so restrictive about where you can and can't fly, and then you allow someone to take a hobby drone and fly with 500 meters away from a military installation, where they can still take pictures, it makes no sense. That's where you should be clamping down on security. And that's where you should say, all right, it should be at least 800 meters at a minimum for military installations. So yeah, I think that's, for the first time, I'm going to say that they need to be a little bit more conservative in this figure and increase that. We have to ensure that people aren't allowed visual access to photographs or through LiDAR or through anything else to be able to take data from these institutions. They have to protect it. 500 meters is actually not going to cut it.
I'm going to reiterate again, of course, that this is still a draft policy. It's open for public comment. I will attach the person that you need to reach out to, but listeners are welcome to reach out to us as well. You can reach us on Twitter at @ekdrishti. Shivan, I believe you are intending to file a response. Is that right?
Yes, I will be filing a response, and there's I think 3 or 4 points that I'll absolutely will be bringing up, as we've already covered.
So I know we've discussed this at the beginning. You know, where do you see this as a market and as well as from a skill point of view for India, say 5 or 10 years down the road from?
So as a market, you will see an entire ecosystem of small to large businesses adopting drones in their everyday lives. Hopefully, we will see Flipkart and Amazon India using drones for deliveries. So consumers will see a massive speed increase in how quickly products are getting to them. This is the logistics side of things. You'll see better data and hopefully lives saved in disaster response situations where drones. Already, we've had, you know, hurricanes, storms in South America and in the American coastline as well. And drones have been very successfully used to be able to generate lots of data on what's happening so that people can get, you know, the right amount of aid in a very short amount of time. And that's a massive place where you'll see, hopefully, within the next 5 years, drones are going to be like a standard for disaster response. You will see an entire tech industry, to summarize what I already said earlier, prop up around drones, both in hardware and in software development, because we as a country are already a giant in this field. It just makes sense. Look, a drone is essentially a flying computer. We're pretty damn good with computers. There's no reason why we're not going to be just as good on flying computers. It's the same analogy applies. And we'll see, hopefully, better urban infrastructure development, widespread drone use, and agriculture as well. Here's what I say as a commercial drone operator. A lot of times, I'm sitting down and I list out 5 things that I think are going to be big. Turns out, when I actually talk to clients, they come up with more interesting things and more uses for drones than even I can think of, because it's a tool. You have to look at a drone as a tool, and it's up to the businesses of India on how they want to use it.
You mentioned, you know, the software bit and so on. I believe anyway, there are already companies in India today that are doing the software side of things for drones, whether it's analysis and flight planning and other patterns.
Absolutely. So there's a company, I think, based out of Mumbai called Netra. They've been in this for a while, been following their progress. They built India's first indigenously developed drone, not from outside Chinese components, but everything was made in India. They had headlines because, you know, this drone was used to monitor public rallies by Prime Minister Narendra Modi for security. So yeah, it's not like the industry is new. It's just that it will really take off once the commercial applications are more defined and once the regulations are more defined. As far as software is concerned, yeah, there are a lot of companies that are currently developing software solutions, but they're actually not marketing them in India. They're marketing them abroad.
And what about the hardware side? I mean, just logically, it would imply once companies start using drones in day-to-day things, in day-to-day operations, and you would obviously have specialized drone operators like yourselves, you know, starting to operate and bringing that expertise, it automatically should start creating the secondary industry around it, right? When you talk about the repairs and the services and the experts on the hardware side of things. I mean, I think of the smartphone industry in a way as a parallel here, because that's kind of what happened in the last 2 or 3 years, where you had China, and again, they're the guys that build all the components anyway today, even for drones, but that's true for smartphones as well. And we're already starting to see, they might be sourcing parts from elsewhere, maybe something's manufactured, but they're starting to assemble things and having that kind of factory operation. Do you see this sort of industry as well developing on? Because yes, we've got the software on site, but would it be logical that the hardware stuff will start, you know, coming indoors as well, because the companies would start needing it?
Well, yes. Well, the thing is, with hardware, right, as far as drones are concerned, depending on how well the industry scales in the next five to 10 years, you will see whether there'll be a massive hardware and services related to that side of things. So the repair and maintenance of drones. I don't always see them as cars. So, you know, you will not see like garages popping up everywhere. There are obviously going to be commercial operators that can service drones, but most of the time it's usually done in-house. So if a company is operating drones, they're going to have people that are in charge of servicing drones as well, because drones a bit like, it's a very, very personal thing. You have to really know what's happening with it to be able to keep track of it. You can't always send it away and expect the technician to, you know, do a great job of it. Eventually, if it scales up and then you have hundreds of drones flying every day, doing everyday tasks, and you have flying taxis and drones that are doing cargo operations instead of cargo planes, and we're talking really long term here, then yes, what you said will actually happen, where an entire ecosystem will pop up around the maintenance and service side of things. But in the beginning, it'll just be all done in-house.
Shivan, thank you so much for all your input. As I mentioned already, I know you will be submitting a response. I know I had a few people on Twitter speaking to me about trying to compose a response because they had some reservations too. So I do encourage everybody to do so. Shivan, would you like to share your Twitter handle if people would like to follow you or ask you questions?
Sure. If you want to ask me questions about this, obviously I'm a commercial drone guy. I love drones. I do this for a living. Ask me anything. I'm not a policy guy. I'll give you my straight up opinion on what I think. You can reach out to me at Airspective. That's AIRSPECTIV. And Chirag, thank you so much for having me on board. It was amazing talking to you about this. I think we're in an exciting phase for the drone industry to finally actually kick off. And I'm actually really looking forward to seeing how this plays out.